Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading the San Angelo Standard Times for the week of Sunday, March 27th, 2022. I'll begin with the most recent articles. We'll also include a few state articles. High-speed crash near Sonora kills one, injures three, by Elena Edgen, published March 31st. One man died and three others were injured after a high-speed crash near Sonora on Thursday, according to a Texas Department of Public Safety news release. About 2:24 a.m. Thursday, March 31st, Sonora police attempted to stop a 2014 Chevrolet Malibu for a traffic violation. The driver, identified as a 17-year-old from Spring, sped more than 100 miles per hour on the 55-mile-per-hour road and turned off the Malibu's lights, according to the release. As the Chevrolet drove eastbound on Farm to Market 3130, the driver lost control at a curve. The car entered the westbound Barrow Ditch, drove through a fence, and hit multiple trees. Two passengers were ejected, one of whom died, according to the release. No Rolando Hernandez Lopez, 32, who was listed as an undocumented non-citizen, died. He was not wearing a seatbelt. The other passengers were also non-citizens, according to the release. The three injured people were all transported to Shannon Medical Center in San Angelo with non-incapacitating injuries. San Angelo man arrested after woman sexually assaulted at family shelter, by Elena Edgen, published March 30th. A man hid in a bathroom, grabbed a woman, and sexually assaulted her at a San Angelo shelter, according to an arrest affidavit. On Monday, March 28th, police arrived at Shannon Medical Center and met with a woman who reported she had been sexually assaulted at the family shelter. During the assault, a male resident bit her back and placed his arms against her neck, which impeded her breathing, records state. Surveillance footage from the shelter showed a man enter the woman's room while she was not there. The man hid in the woman's bathroom, then ran out, grabbed her arm, and forced her into a closet, according to an affidavit. She begged him to leave and stop, but the man continued the assault, according to the affidavit. Police arrested Joel Alejandro de la Cruz, 35, Tuesday on suspicion of sexual assault in Tom Green County and a failure to appear warrant from San Patricio County. He remained in Tom Green County Detention Center in lieu of a $205,100 bond as of 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, according to jail records. The Family Shelter is a nonprofit organization that provides family housing and counseling to victims of domestic violence. Executive Director Jerry Sloan said the incident was immediately reported to law enforcement and the family shelter is working with authorities during their investigation. Police chase results in child endangerment charge. One arrest in San Angelo. An argument over beer led to an assault, a child in danger, and one arrest in San Angelo on Tuesday, according to an arrest affidavit. On Monday, March 28th, police arrived at a residence on Paint Rock Road for a reported assault. A woman told officers a member of her household punched her in the head and bit her hand, causing bleeding and loss of fingernails, records state. Officers noted the woman's left eye was bleeding, along with her hands and elbows. She said that an argument occurred over buying the person beer. Then the person started assaulting her before taking her car and 10-month-old child. This was not the first time the person had assaulted her or been arrested on assault charges, according to the affidavit. Officers found the vehicle near Metcalf and Avenue I and attempted a traffic stop. The driver fled at a high rate of speed, failed to stop at two stop signs, and police halted the pursuit for child safety reasons, according to the affidavit. Police arrested Pamela Monique Ramirez, 20, Tuesday on suspicion of assault on a family household member, evading arrest, detention with a vehicle, and child endangerment with criminal intent, knowledge, recklessness, criminal negligence. She remained in Tom Green County Detention Center in lieu of a $40,000 bond as of 11:15 a.m. Wednesday, according to online jail records. State prosecutors will pursue death penalty against San Angelo man for 2021 homicide, by Elena Edgen, published March 29th. A San Angelo man could receive the death penalty in connection to a 2021 homicide, a case which included three Abilene teens and months of investigation, according to online court records. On March 23rd, state prosecutors filed a notice of intent to seek the death penalty against David Alexander Rodriguez, 23, in connection to the shooting of Jacob Hernandez, 26, during an attempted burglary. The state hereby provides formal written notice to the court and the defendant that the state intends to seek the death penalty in the event of conviction in the above-styled cause, the notice stated. Rodriguez is one of four people charged in the death. The other co-defendants, all 18-year-olds from Abilene, are Eric Anthony Aguin, Amethyst Alaya Deonda, and Francisco Josiah Morales. Abilene teens travel to San Angelo, ends in death of Jacob Hernandez. About 3:24 a.m., May 26, 2021, police arrived at an apartment in the 2400 block of Lily Street to a reported shooting. An officer found a gun on the apartment steps and damage to the front door frame and lock, according to an arrest affidavit. Officers found Hernandez lying on his back on a bed with a fatal gunshot wound to the chest. The next 8 months would reveal a plan between the three Abilene teens and a San Angelo man. On December 1st, 2021, police interviewed Morales in Taylor County Jail. He said he had been communicating with another man, who he refused to identify, from May 25th to 26th about committing a lick, a criminal incident, according to court documents. Investigators spoke to Deonda and Aguian on June 22nd, who stated they and Morales traveled to San Angelo. They arrived at a house where a man, later identified as Rodriguez, entered the vehicle and drove them to a location where Morales picked up a gun, records state. They then drove to Lily Street and entered the apartment, where Morales said he fired the gun and left the firearm in the area. Investigators obtained Facebook messages and phone data from the Abilene teens, which led them to Rodriguez. While messages had been deleted, phone records placed Rodriguez with the group at Lily Street around 3:20 a.m. May 26th. Video surveillance from the apartment also showed a dark-colored sedan enter the parking lot and two people wearing garments and face coverings to hide their identities enter the apartment, records state. Capital murder arrests made in Abilene and San Angelo. Morales was the first arrest in the case on June 17, 2021, in Taylor County. He was indicted in September for capital murder, intending other felony. He has remained in Taylor County Jail since June in lieu of a $1,027,500 bond as of 2:30 p.m. Tuesday, according to online jail records. A court date has not been scheduled. Rodriguez, the second arrest, was booked into Tom Green County Detention Center on January 21st and indicted in February for capital murder, intending other felony. He remained in the detention center in lieu of a $1,155,000 bond as of 2:30 p.m. Tuesday, according to online jail records. Aguian was arrested in Taylor County under the indicted charge of capital murder, intending other felony, on February 10th and booked into Tom Green County a week later. He remained in the detention center in lieu of a $500,000 bond as of 2:30 p.m. Tuesday, according to online jail records. Abilene police asked the public's help to find Deonda in February and arrested her under the indicted capital murder, intending other felony, on February 21st. She was booked into Tom Green County Jail on March 2nd and released March 25th on a $100,000 bond, according to online jail records. A court date has not been scheduled. On target, San Angelo teenager among the world's best in rifle shooting, by Charles Bryce, published March 28th. Quietly going about his business, San Angelo teenager Brandon Pizer has established himself as one of the best competitors in the world in his age group while competing in a sport that often gets overlooked. The 17-year-old is a competitive shooter who competes in rifle and currently represents USA Shooting. At the Junior World Championships in Lima, Peru, on September 28th through October 9th, Pizer was one of 8 U.S. medalists in rifle, and he helped set 2 world records while competing in a field of more than 400 athletes representing 30 different countries. Pizer teamed with Molly McGinn from West Virginia University for a second-place finish in the 50-meter prone mixed team event. "We ended up setting a world record for prone," Pizer said. "We beat the world record in the second round of qualification, and in the gold medal match for the finals, we ended up getting silver." In the 3-man team competition, Pizer teamed with Gavin Barnick and Rylan Kissel, who both compete for the University of Alaska Fairbanks, for a bronze medal. "We set the world record on the first round of qualification," the San Angelo teen said. "We went into the bronze medal match and we won that, so we ended up in third place." Individually, Pizer was 9th in the 50-meter prone event and 4th in the 50-meter three positions event. Pizer has another international competition coming up soon. He's scheduled to compete at the International Shooting Sport Federation, ISSF, Junior World Cup in Seoul, Germany, on May 9th through the 20th. "I'm looking forward to it a lot, and it's good encouragement for matches," Pizer said. "If you don't have matches coming up, it's kind of hard to have the dedication to it in practice." Pizer would be a junior at Wall High School, but he switched to homeschooling in February. "I had to switch due to the number of absences for rifle," said Pizer, who is taking classes at Texas Tech Online High School. "It's a lot better fit for travel." Getting an early start in the sport has paid off for Pizer. "I started shooting just about when I could walk, and then I started in 4-H when I was 8, Braden said. "At my first USA shooting competition, I was 11. Braden's coaching carousel. Jeff Pizer, Braden's father and the current president of the local 4-H club, was his longtime shooting coach from the early days before private coaches took over. "He's beyond what I know how to coach," his dad said with a grin. "When I quit coaching him, he started with Lucas Kaczynski, who's an Olympian and won silver at the last Olympics. And now his coach is Jamie Shipley. She was a 2-time Olympian in 1996 and 2000. She's out of Hollywood, Florida. They do virtual coaching once a week." And even though she's hundreds of miles away, Shipley is making Pizer better at his craft. "I guess the main thing is coaching me on how to coach myself," the San Angeloan said. "I'm learning how to find the problems myself without having her there 24/7. I can accomplish more in practices, or I can figure out problems in a match on my own more often instead of having issues." As far as practices go, Pizer hasn't been shooting his 22 caliber rifle as much recently due to his back being a little out of whack. But normally, he hits the home range 5 days a week for 3 to 4 hours at a time. "It's a workout regimen that requires a lot of discipline, and his father says he's got nerves of steel." "Even out of competitions, he's the same," Jeff Pizer said. "I think that's what makes him so good is he doesn't have emotional highs and lows. He's just always steady." "On the other hand, I'm a nervous wreck. I almost get sick to my stomach watching him, but he's always calm, whether it's a practice or it's down to him and one other person trying to win the gold medal at a national or international competition. Pizer's competition 22 rifle is connected to his laptop, which records his accuracy on targets. Real bullets aren't fired. What's next? Pizer has some big goals in the near future. An individual medal in an international match is what I'm going for, because the two I got in Peru were with the teams, he said. That and going to college on a rifle team. Not very many colleges offer competitive shooting as a sport, but several of them are, and they're already knocking on his door. That first week that he could officially be contacted, we got calls from West Point and the Naval Academy, and we had already talked to the Air Force Academy, Jeff Pizer said. Alaska Fairbanks and the University of Kentucky have also shown interest, he said. Jeff Pizer spoke about how much he's seen his son grow in the sport over the years. The maturity level is off the charts, his father said. He pretty much takes care of his own business, whether it's rifle or school. We're not looking over his shoulder the whole time, telling him to do this or telling him to do that. Just as the maturity and focus on what he does, it's been very impressive to watch and makes us very proud. When he thinks about Braden going off to college in the near future, Jeff Pizer gets a little emotional. Yeah, I don't even like to think about it, Jeff Pizer said. In a year and a half, he'll be off at college shooting on an NCAA team. They'll be the ones taking him to all the matches. Finding new local talent. Jeff Pizer has been working on getting a shooting range for the local 4-H club, and things are starting to fall into place. It looks like we're finally going to get a place for the kids to learn safety and shooting here in the next month or two, the local 4-H president said. Brandon Pizer has some advice for youngsters who might want to give competitive shooting a try. I think getting started in 4-H is the first step, the 17-year-old said. That's where I started. You meet the right people that you need, whether you want to get better in 4-H or if you want to take it to the next step and start in USA shooting and international competitions later on if you can. Doug Hemhill and his daughter Kristen, who are from the nearby community of Lawn, also helped Braden get started. Kristen is now a standout on Texas Christian University's women's rifle team. Youngsters who are interested in signing up for 4-H competitions have to go through the Texas AgriLife County Extension agent first, and then Jeff Pizer will contact them. We have about 40 kids signed up, he said. I'm hoping that'll grow next year. Our kids this year have been waiting for me to get the range built so we have a safe place for them to practice and learn. If you're interested in joining the Tom Green County Rifle Club, log on to https://tomgreen.agrilife.org. The people have spoken. Here are the streets San Angelo wants fixed and their status. By Elena Edgen, published March 25th. With the recent completion of the majority of the Bell Street road work in San Angelo, we asked readers to suggest which road they want fixed next in a Facebook post last Thursday. As of 12:38 p.m. Friday, the streets with the most votes were Chadburn, 72, and College Hills, 41. Final other results were all other streets, 20. 29th Street, 16. Howard, 16. Sunset Rio Concho Drive, 5. Southwest and West Avenue Inn, 4. Van Buren, 3. Bell and Oaks, 2. 18th Street, Bowie, Concho, Colwell, Edmond, Glenna, Hughes, Marks, Mission, North Abe, Paint Rock Road, and Red Bluff, each one. The streets with the most votes are actually in the process of renovation. Here's a look at where those roads are in the construction process as of March 2022 Street Project Report. Bell Street. Status: active. With a $22 million price and completion expected in the first quarter of 2022, roadway construction, curbs, sidewalk, and utilities are complete. Paving for the St. Anne intersection, installation of traffic signals, and pedestrian elements are ongoing. Chadbourne Street. Downtown Chadbourne status: active. The plan includes reconstructing the roadway, rehabilitating aging utilities, improving pedestrian safety and access on the downtown portion from the Concho River to Beauregard Avenue. The cost is $7.6 million with an estimated completion of July 2022. The street, sidewalk, and traffic signal portions are finished. Landscaping, amenities, a pedestrian ramp, and striping are ongoing. North Chadbourne status: active. With an estimated $4.7 million cost, and there is not an estimated completion date. This includes reconstruction of the road from Loop 306 to 43rd Street. The water main has been replaced. The sewer main replacement is 15% finished, and the street portion is nearing the bidding stage. Chadbourne from Avenue L to Avenue B status: design phase is in progress. This will have reconstruction of the roadway. College Hills Boulevard. Status: active, with a $32.6 million estimated price tag and expected to begin in May 2022. The projection is for College Hills Boulevard from Loop 306 to Avenue N. This includes reconstruction of the roadway, drainage work, underground utilities, signalized intersection upgrades, and ADA-compliant sidewalks and ramps. Edmund, Glenna, and 29th Street. Status: design phase is 60% complete. This will include mill and overlay, reconstruction of the roadways, and utility rehabilitation. Howard Street. Status: design phase is 60% complete. It will include mill and overlay, reconstruction of the roadway, and utility rehabilitation on Howard Street from South Glenna to Sherwood Way. Oak Street. Status: this is a future project in which the Texas Department of Transportation will repair the Oak Street Bridge. The city will match 10% of the cost. Rio Concho Drive. Status: active, with a cost of $1.4 million. The project will have full depth reclamation of the roadway. Is set to begin in April 2022 and finish in the summer of 2022. Southwest Boulevard. Status: active, with a cost of $7.04 million. Estimated completion in April 2022. The project includes mill and overlay, drainage and reconstruction work. The overlay and reconstruction parts are finished. The low water crossing is in progress, and striping will be done after. Sunset Drive. Status: this is a future project which will go into the design phase sometime this year. The estimated cost is $11.8 million for Sunset Drive from Loop 306 near Academy to Foster Road. It will have mill and overlay. Further down the road, the city plans to have projects on East Harris Street, Johnson Street, Cristoval Road, Avenue N, and Smith Boulevard. For more information on street projects, visit cosets.us/departments-services/public-works/street-projects-and-general-information. Two more arrests made in 2020, double homicide originating from drug deal. By Gabriel Monte, Lubbock Avalanche Journal, published March 25th. two more people from San Angelo are facing felony charges in connection with the double homicide 2 years ago in East Lubbock. Bobby Gaska, 22, and Camry Hewitt, 29, were arrested in San Angelo on Thursday, according to Lubbock police officials. Gaska faces a count of capital murder in connection with the July 2, 2020 shooting that killed 31-year-old Michael Carson and 64-year-old Gregory Tubbs in the 300 block of Beach Avenue in Lubbock. Hewitt was arrested on a charge of failure to report a felony. The two were booked into the Tom Green County Jail and will be taken to Lubbock County later. Edward Germain Wilson, 26, was arrested about a week after the shooting in San Angelo and is facing two separate counts of murder. The charges stem from a Lubbock Metropolitan Special Crimes Unit investigation that began when police officers responding to a shots fired call in the area found Carson and Tubbs inside a home dead from apparent gunshot wounds. A witness told Lubbock Metro Special Crimes investigators that Carson was supposed to meet with two people from San Angelo to sell them crack cocaine, according to the arrest warrant. Investigators inspecting Carson's phone found phone numbers he was in contact with around the time of the shooting. One of the numbers that Carson's phone contacted before the shooting was listed as John Doe with a San Angelo address that he later learned was Wilson's from 2002 to 2018, the warrant states. Another witness told the investigator he was walking down the street by the residence when a white four-door car pulled into the driveway of the home. The witness said he recognized the vehicle as Carson's. Carson and Tubbs exited the vehicle and went inside the house. Meanwhile, the witness said a black man exited a white SUV parked nearby and came in the house after Carson and Tubbs. He said he saw a Hispanic woman with long hair in the driver's seat of the SUV, the warrant states. The witness told the investigators he continued walking, but heard what he believed to be gunshots about 3 to 4 minutes later. He turned and saw the black man running out of the house, clutching something in front of his belly, and got into the SUV, which sped off. A third witness told investigators she was at the MLK Park in San Angelo 3 days after the shooting and heard Wilson and Gaska bragging to a crowd of people, who were mostly their family members, about going to Lubbock to rob Carson and Tubbs, the warrant states. She said the men told the crowd that something happened during the robbery, and the two men got shot and they ended up stealing the money and drugs from Carson and Tubbs. The third witness told investigators that Wilson always carried a black handgun, and she said she witnessed another shooting at the park on Juneteenth, during which Wilson was in a gun battle with another man. A U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosive agent compared the shell casings recovered from the June 20th, 2020 park shooting with the ones from Carson and Tubbs' shootings. The shell casings from the shooting in San Angelo were a positive match to the shell casings recovered at the scene of the murders of Carson and Tubbs, the warrant states. She stated, "Wilson and the other man, who has not been arrested, are often with a long-haired Hispanic woman who drives a small white SUV. Wilson, who has been held at the Lubbock County Detention Center since July 9, 2020, was set to go on trial on February 28 in the 364th District Court. However, the judge granted a continuance when more discovery evidence surfaced." Angelo State's men's basketball coach, Cinco Boone, resigns, by Paul Harris, published March 28. Angelo State University announced the resignation of men's head basketball coach Cinco Boone on Monday, March 28. Boone recently completed his seventh season as the Rams head coach, leading them to a 20-10 record and a spot in the NCAA Division II South Central Regional Tournament. The number 7-seeded Rams lost 84-76 to West Texas A&M in the opening round. Boone compiled a 129-67 record at ASU and reached the regional tournament four times. His first season was his best, as the Rams went 25-7 and fell just short of advancing to the national tournament with a 77-72 loss to Tarleton State in the regional final. Boone arrived at ASU in 2013 as an assistant under head coach Chris Beard. The two worked together the prior season at McMurray University in Abilene. The Rams were 47-15 during Boone's 2 years as an assistant, giving him an overall record of 176-82 during his 9 years at the school. Boone is a native of Portales, New Mexico, where he graduated high school and attended college at Eastern New Mexico. ASU will begin the process of finding a new head coach immediately, its release stated. Pipelines versus landowners. Texas Supreme Court to settle fight over private property rights. Texas law allows pipeline companies to seize private land for projects in the public interest. But what happens when a landowner disputes a claim that a pipeline project has a public benefit? By John C. Mortis, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published March 20th. Austin. Two of Texas's bedrock principles, the right of private property owners to be fairly compensated when their land is seized, and the right of private business to take the land it needs to bring oil products to the market, are on a collision course, waiting for the state Supreme Court to determine which principle will prevail. At issue in this 6-year battle, now under review by the High Court, is a 30-foot strip of land that runs about 2 miles through 16,000 acres of farmland in Brazoria County, owned by brothers Terrence and Kenneth Hlavinka. In 2016, the landowners were approached by Enterprise Products Partners, which planned to build a pipeline to send a liquefied gas called propylene from Texas City to a plant in Freeport. The brothers have no objection to the project, but they rejected the offered price they thought was worth just pennies on the dollar to what their land was worth. They purchased the property some 20 years ago, fully expecting to add to the 24 pipelines that were already snaking their way across the farmland. As such, Terrence Hlavinka added, they intended to recoup their investment by selling pipeline easements. The position of that property is such that if you want to get something in the pipeline from Freeport to the Houston Ship Channel, you got to go through us, he said in a recent interview. The Hlavinkas wanted $3.3 million for the easement. That's about what they had received for the most recent pipeline project on their property. Enterprise's offer was closer to about $135,000, basing the offer on the going rate for agriculture land in the area. The true measure of the value, the Hlavinkas countered, was what the last willing buyer had paid for the comparable dirt. Conflicting court rulings over Texas pipeline rights. And that's when it went to the courts. An Enterprise subsidiary called HSC Pipeline invoked the doctrine of eminent domain, which gives what are called common carrier pipelines the same right to condemn land that the government has when it's for a project in the public interest. And as such, the entity doing the condemnation has the upper hand in setting the fair market value of the land. The Hlavinkas pushed back. They argued the propylene in question was simply a product sold by one company for use by another and used to make plastics. It could hardly be likened to natural gas or to crude oil that would be refined into gasoline and consumed by motorists across Texas and beyond, they said. The pipeline company won the trial court in Brazoria County, which found that HSC qualifies as a common carrier. It also said Terrence Hlavinka could not testify as an expert witness on the value of the land being taken. The first court of appeals in Houston found otherwise. During documents before the Texas Supreme Court in late February, Justice Deborah Learman pressed the common carrier question. Wasn't this pipeline built specifically for the purpose of transporting to one specific customer? Larimore asked HSC attorney David Keltner. And isn't that really the key issue? Keltner said no. As long as there's reasonable probability that sometime after construction that there will be additional traffic or more than one customer that will ship on the line, that's enough, he said. In their brief to the Supreme Court, HCS's lawyers argued that Texas law gives pipeline companies wide latitude when it comes to making sure energy products can be brought to the market. Eminent domain ensures that no single landowner can hold an entire common carrier pipeline project hostage by refusing to sell an easement, demanding unreasonable compensation, or dictating an inefficient route, the brief said. The industry needs jurisprudential certainty for this power before committing to the time and expense of pipeline construction and operation, and in order to market the pipeline to unaffiliated shippers. In their brief, lawyers for the property owners argued that HSC's claim of eminent domain authority is not supported by law. Texas companies should not be permitted to circumvent express statutory limitations to condemnation rights at the expense of valuable property and constitutional rights of Texas landowners, the brief states. Texas Pipeline Interests Groups Weigh In. The company is backed by several oil and gas organizations that say if the Supreme Court allows the lower court ruling to stand, it would be a major blow to the industry's ability to bring energy products to the market. The appeals court ruling, the Texas Pipeline Association said in a brief filed in the Supreme Court, discourages construction of new pipelines and makes it significantly more difficult and expensive to build them. Texas has both the largest oil and gas production resources in the nation and the largest pipeline infrastructure, the brief said. The pipeline systems are the necessary connections between that production and the facilities that provide the public with the products of the oil and gas industry. Without the ability to move oil and gas resources into and out of those facilities efficiently and economically, Texas will lose advantages of its unique energy infrastructure. In their brief on behalf of the Hlavinka brothers, the Texas Farm Bureau and Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association said that if pipeline companies are left free to seize land on the cheap when the public interests is not in play, the rights of private property owners would suffer. Texas rural landowners and livestock producers have come under assault in recent years from the constant encroachment of economic development, oil and gas production, and an ever-increasing and extensive system of pipelines, many of which are for export from the U.S. or serve only a single corporate interest, the organization said. The system is grossly unbalanced. The court has not said when a decision would be made in the case. Terrence Hlavinka and his family has oil interests and is not looking to hamstring the industry's ability to bring petroleum products to the market. We're not anti-oil and gas, he said. We're completing an oil well as we speak. We're invested in several forms of energy production. Oil and gas is certainly one of those. Our desire is to get fair and just compensation as provided by the state constitution. In Texas, calls to boost oil production after Russian invasion runs into hard realities. By Mitchell Furman, Texas Tribune, published March 28th, Midland. After Russia invaded Ukraine last month, and the U.S. and major energy companies boycotted Russian oil and gas, some politicians quickly called for cranking up American energy production to fill the void. A Republican member of Congress attended President Joe Biden's State of the Union address earlier this month, wearing a shirt emblazoned with "Drill, Baby, Drill." U.S. Representative Philemon Vela, a Democrat from Brownsville, tweeted, "Save Ukraine. Unleash American oil and gas." And U.S. Representative August Pfluger, Republican San Angelo, who represents the heart of Texas's oil patch, has painted red, white, and blue baseball caps with an oil pump jack next to the words Midland over Moscow. The energy producers of West Texas and America are ready to produce the energy our nation and allies need, Pfluger wrote on Twitter. But in Texas's Permian Basin, the nation's most productive oil region and the place that would have to lead any jump in U.S. production, people in the industry, energy analysts, and local leaders say there's no quick or easy way to make that happen. Cranking up production requires more workers, materials, and money, and people in the industry say they're facing the same labor shortages and supply chain issues that have plagued countless businesses throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. On top of that, they say Wall Street investors have become more hesitant about pouring money into fossil fuels, and the Biden administration's policies are hampering the oil and gas industry. It's hard to get pipe, sand, crews for drilling rigs, truck drivers, said Mike Westman, CEO of Tall City Exploration, a company that drills oil wells in West Texas and has two active rigs that drill 32 wells per year combined. He said the scarcity of supplies, equipment, and people is unlike anything I've ever seen. He said frac sand, a key ingredient in the hydraulic fracturing process, has been particularly hard to find, in part to labor shortages, even though much of the supply comes from Texas. The price of steel has increased so much that supply shortages makes it hard to get pipe for drilling wells, he added. Westman said his company has no plans to add more drilling rigs, but even if it did, he said it probably wouldn't be able to find the supplies to do so. And I talked to a guy yesterday, a bigger company than us, trying to ramp up his operation to 6 rigs, and he goes, I don't know if I can get all the things I need to do that, Westman said. John Volke, CEO of Crew Support Services, a company that houses oil field workers in temporary quarters known as man camps, says his company has filled every one of its 1,500 beds in the Permian. Every one of our clients are trying to hire 20 to 40 people, field hands, labor for rigging pipe, Volke said. I don't know where these people went to work. Amazon? Westman said when the demand for oil and gas plummeted at the start of the pandemic, many oil field workers got out of the industry for good. We quit drilling for a year. A lot of people slowed down, Westman said. All those people that were working in the field, a lot of them just said, enough's enough, I'm out. Juan Cano left the industry in 2019 and isn't returning. The 57-year-old has worked many jobs over the years, driving trucks, laying asphalt, and now fixing vehicles at a Midland auto shop. Like many people living in the Permian Basin, he's been lured into oil field jobs during previous booms. But even with oil-related businesses desperate for workers and the price of oil topping $100 a barrel following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Cano said the appeal of more money isn't strong enough this time. I don't want to go back into that up and down swing, Cano said last week outside the auto shop. It's not stable, especially now with everything going on in the world. Replacing Russian oil? The Biden administration announced a U.S. boycott on Russian oil on March 8th, but only about 7% of U.S. oil imports come from Russia. A handful of other countries like Britain and Canada, plus some major energy companies like ExxonMobil and Shell, have also stopped buying Russian oil. The International Energy Agency estimates that by April, 3 million barrels per day of Russian oil production could be off the global market as sanctions take hold and buyers shun exports. But nearly all European countries that rely heavily on Russian oil haven't followed the U.S. lead, and Biden hasn't pushed other countries much on the issue for fear that such a boycott could hurt the world economy more than it hurts Russia. The world consumes around 100 million barrels of oil per day, and Russia produces about 11.2 million barrels per day, making it the third largest producer behind the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. The IEA, which was formed after the 1973 oil crisis to ensure a steady worldwide energy market, said the repercussions of Russia's invasion are likely to grow over the next several months as summer driving season begins. The world may well be facing its biggest oil supply shock in decades, with huge implications for our economies and societies, said IEA Executive Director Faith Birrell, citing the uncertain future of Russian supplies on the global market as the war continues and sanctions against the nation mount. In the U.S., no place drills for oil as much as the Permian Basin. As of March 11th, the region had 316 oil rigs in the ground. The number continually flashing on a large screen in downtown Midland, along with the current temperature. The rest of the U.S. had 212 rigs, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Each rig can have dozens of individual wells. The Permian produces more than 5 million of the nation's daily output of 11.6 million barrels of oil per day. Local officials say the war in Ukraine, which has pushed the price of oil up 58% from the start of the year, will boost profits for the oil and gas already being produced in the Permian Basin. When the world supply is interrupted, which it is, it just makes our product that much more important, Bobby Burns, president of the Midland Chamber of Commerce and the city's former mayor, said last week at the Permian Basin Petroleum Museum. "We're of mixed minds about the Russia-Ukraine conflict," Burns added. "We know it's strengthening our bottom line, but it's bad for the world." Before Russia invaded Ukraine, the Permian Basin's oil production had finally surpassed pre-pandemic levels as the global economy recovered. The U.S. Energy Information Administration forecasts that production in the Permian region will average about 5.3 million barrels per day in 2022 and will reach 5.7 million barrels per day in 2023, which would be a record high. Some investors are less bullish on oil investments. To significantly boost production in the Permian, companies have to secure major financial backing. Historically, that backing has come from Wall Street, which has dictated tremendously what goes on in the industry out here, said Stephen Robertson, executive vice president of the Permian Basin Petroleum Association, adding that drillers decide how much oil to produce one way or another based on signals they are getting from Wall Street. Prior to the pandemic, Wall Street was already starting to see oil and gas as a riskier investment because of environmental concerns, said Stephen Beach, dean of the business school at the University of Texas Permian Basin. For example, the Rockefeller family, which became wealthy and famous in the late 1800s from founding the Standard Oil Empire, whose successors include Chevron and ExxonMobil, sold off all its fossil fuel investments in 2015 because of concerns about climate change. Other investors have cooled on the energy sector for purely bottom-line reasons. More than half of 132 oil and gas executives surveyed by the Dallas Fed said this week that pressure by investors to provide a better return on investments is the main reason energy companies are restraining growth despite high oil prices. Beach said energy company shareholders were wondering why their companies produced so much oil and gas from 2017 to 19, and it was so dirt cheap. And at the end of the day, they didn't really make much money off of it. Matt Coday, president and founder of the Oil and Gas Workers Association, based in Odessa, blamed the Biden administration's decisions on energy policy for some of the investors' hesitancy to put money into the industry. He said Biden signaled to the industry on his first day in office that he does not support oil and gas by suspending the Keystone XL pipeline. Coday said the administration's decision to halt new oil leases on federal land also created a chilling effect within the industry. "We've got U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen asking banks to defund fossil fuel projects, Kode said, referring to Yellen's push for banks to align their portfolios with the world's climate goals, which includes cutting investments in oil and gas. Still, the world relies heavily on oil and gas, and Beach said the ongoing labor shortages, supply chain problems, and financial and political uncertainty are creating major headwinds for energy companies trying to meet the demand. The confluence of these issues are making it more challenging for companies to decide whether they're going to start ramping up production again, Beach said. Texas COVID case and hospitalization numbers are falling to pre-Omicron levels. Texas hospitals are breathing a sigh of relief, but an industry spokesperson says we know that we're not out of the woods. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published March 25th, Austin. New COVID-19 infection rates in Texas have plummeted to pre-Omicron levels, and hospitalizations are the lowest since June 2021. But the average number of deaths per day has ticked up over the last week, according to the most recent statistics compiled by Johns Hopkins University. The trend lines from the Baltimore-based university, which has published state-by-state analyses of COVID's progress since March 2020, show new infections and hospitalizations at a near-flat trajectory for almost 3 weeks. That's a marked contrast from the almost vertical spike that started around Thanksgiving and kept climbing until January 15th, when the seven-day average of new cases in Texas neared 65,000. The descent from mid-January to mid-March was just as dramatic, as the present seven-day new case average fell to around 2,200. Carrie Williams, a spokeswoman for the Texas Hospital Association, said medical facilities around the state are seeing a much-needed break because of the declining number of people requiring inpatient treatment for COVID symptoms. Before the widespread availability of vaccines and other advances in treatments in early January 2021, Texas was seeing daily COVID hospitalization rates as high as 15,000. The present seven-day average is closer to around 1,500. It is definitely a move in the right direction, Williams said, but we've experienced highs and lows before. We know that we're not out of the woods, and we know that COVID is still circulating. The vibe is good, but we definitely continue to be on high alert, as we have been for the last 2 years. Since the start of the pandemic, Texas has recorded some 6.7 million COVID cases, according to Johns Hopkins. The university's numbers largely track those from the Texas Department of State Health Services. However, the state separates what it calls probable cases from confirmed cases. Texas has also seen 87,062 COVID-related deaths as of midweek, according to Johns Hopkins. That's nearly as many as the 88,351 California has seen. California, the nation's largest state, has 10.4 million more people than Texas does, which is the second largest state. California also has a higher rate of fully vaccinated people than Texas has, 71.4% versus 62.2%. According to the Texas Department of State Health Services, an unvaccinated person is 41 times more likely to die from a COVID-related illness than someone who is fully vaccinated. Nationally, 65% of people are considered fully vaccinated. The COVID numbers and hospitalization rates in Texas appear to match those of the nation as a whole, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. However, while the rate of COVID-related deaths nationally shows a steady decline, the seven-day average of deaths has risen slightly over the past week, from about 60 to more than 100. Dr. S. Wesley Clark, Director of Diagnostic Microbiology at Houston Methodist Hospital, said the more manageable numbers of COVID cases presents an opportunity for people not only to feel a sense of relief, but to also prepare in case another variant sparks another spike. As we're in sort of a trough where cases are low, now might be the time to pick up an extra box of masks and get those things that might become scarce if there's an uptick, Long said. If you haven't been vaccinated or haven't been boosted, now's the time to do that. And now here is the column by Allison Watkins. Tips for growing pecan trees in West Texas. Published March 25th. Pecans are beautiful native shade trees that also make a delicious, healthy food. They're very popular in the Concho Valley, and many of the questions that come into the Extension office revolve around pecan tree care. Spring is a good time of year to make plans for irrigation, fertilization, and pest control to keep trees healthy, attractive, and productive. As soon as they start to leaf out, apply a zinc foliar spray to help with leaf elongation. Leaves are the food factories for the tree where photosynthesis happens. Bigger leaves help create larger, better-filled nuts. Young trees should be sprayed with zinc every 2 weeks from bud break through June, and large mature trees should receive at least 3 applications through the spring. Zinc is not well absorbed through the soil, so a foliar spray is needed. It is best done on a cool, cloudy day. Nitrogen is absorbed well through the soil and is most effective when applied to the ground and watered in. Don't apply before a predicted heavy rainfall, as that will likely wash the fertilizer down into the streets in stormwater runoff. Apply 1 pound of ammonium sulfate, 21-0-0, or 3/4 of a pound of ammonium nitrate, 33-0-0, per inch of trunk diameter in a broadcast pattern around the drip line of the tree. The pecan nut case bearer, PNC, pest should be evaluated locally at each home or orchard. Trees with a heavy crop set may not need treatment because lessening the crop can increase nut size and quality if it starts out with overload. But with trees with a lighter crop or with a heavy PNC population, treatment will help protect the harvest. Each grower should inspect their trees to get the best timing for treatment, but we do provide an email announcement each spring to those interested in receiving a spray date recommendation. To sign up, visit https://tomgreen.agrilife.org/horticulture. Irrigation is also critical for a healthy tree and plentiful harvest. Pecan trees are not drought-tolerant species and require steady, reliable irrigation when there is no rainfall. Plan to water the drip line thoroughly every week when there is no significant rainfall from spring through fall and monthly through the winter when it's dry. Keep an eye out for caterpillar pests throughout the growing season, such as walnut caterpillar and wall webworm. These hungry insects can defoliate large sections of the canopy, and while they are unlikely to kill the tree, they can reduce the crop yield and are simple to control if caught early. Products like spinosad and BT are very safe to use, but effective when applied according to label direction. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.